welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio with our host from Children at Risk, noted child advocate, and policy expert Mandy Kimball. What do we have on tap today, Bob and Mandy?
And Mandy's gone today.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Right. So we have Katie here today. Katie McConnell's in for Mandy. Katie, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Very good. And we got Katie's sound going. Do we have her sound going now?
There we go. I'm still doing great. I'm not Mandy, but I'm great. Happy Monday!
Yeah, you sound just like Mandy.
I always try to do my best Mandy Kimball impersonation when I try to fill her shoes for this hour. It's so hard, though. So hard.
So Katie, I know that you stay pretty busy. You're a big child activist yourself.
I am. I try to be, at least. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of needs in our community right now, so keeping us all pretty busy and out of trouble.
That's
right. Or getting us into a little bit of trouble because we want justice for our kids.
But I know Katie and I went over the schedule today, the agenda, the script.
Yeah. Some people call it a script.
And we're excited. It's going to be a good show.
It is. We've got a lot to look forward to today. First, we have one of our favorite people, Edith Rahimian from Children at Risk, who's the director of the Center for Parent and Family Wellbeing at Children at Risk. And she's going to talk about the significance of the number $27.6
billion. $27.6. What do you think? What could that be?
It's likely what your raise is going to look like after next legislative session when Children at Risk is more successful than we've ever been. How about that?
Yeah.
Not likely.
No, not likely.
I figure Edith will have something else to share with us today.
That should be good. And we're going to be talking with Amy Willa, who leads the Infant Nutrition and Nurture Engagement Team at Harris County Public Health. She's joining with us to talk about mental and physical health benefits. And I don't know Amy, but I do know that the Infant Nutrition and Nurture Engagement Team does some mighty fine work.
They absolutely do. And as we kick off National Breastfeeding Month, this seemed like the perfect guest to talk about this conversation that still, even in 2018, is taboo for a lot of people.
That's what I was going to say, right? This is sort of a little bit of a taboo thing, but the fact of the matter is that when we look at the data, when we look at the evidence, there's such good data on the impact, the positive impact of breastfeeding.
For baby and mother.
Both, right?
Both, yeah.
And so we do need to talk about this a little bit more. People don't want to talk about it, but we need to.
Well, and then that brings us to our next guest, right, who is kind of on the other end of the spectrum. She's the chair of the Texas Maternal Mortality and Morbidity Task Force to talk to us a little bit about the infant and maternal mortality rate in Texas.
Yeah.
And how shockingly devastating it is.
Yeah, it is. We're going to also be doing our big thumbs up. Thumbs down. This is your favorite segment.
This
Katie.
Is my favorite.
You love this.
I'm a sucker for a fight every time.
And we're going to be talking about year-round school, longer school year. Lisa Leith, who is the chief of field services at Generation Schools. Generation Schools does work in Colorado and I think in New York City as well. And they have indeed a significantly longer school year. So we're going to be talking to them and we'll let people vote. Longer school year, yes or no? Year-round school,
likely,
yes or no?
Yes, I would imagine.
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
I'm just already throwing out my perspective. Right
kids
here.
Will call in and say, no,
yep,
we don't want it. Teachers, no, not necessarily. You were a teacher.
I was.
You were a principal.
I still
would you
say
like
yes.
that?
I would, actually.
Yeah.
I've got about a 10-point bullet list that I'm ready to talk about when we get there.
The data's pretty clear on this, right?
It is pretty clear.
Yeah, very good.
So wrapping up, our guest this afternoon, our final guest will be one of our very good friends and regular guests on the show, Ann Chandler, who's the executive director of Tahereh Justice Center's Houston office, and she will be giving us an update on family separations and discussing the need for a new approach to filing asylum briefs in light of new guidelines. We know some of the focus in our news media has died down around the separation, family separation issue on the border and some different facilities that are potentially opening in our town. It's important to keep talking about it because it's not.
Well, still too many families are still separated.
They
haven't been brought together. They need to be brought together. We need to keep talking about this, Katie, because, you know, when we were doing a series of press conferences across the state, the president came out and said, okay, we're going to stop separating families. And yet here we are, month and a half later,
6 weeks later,
and there are still families separated. It's like we need to continue with this pressure because this is ridiculous. I was at a national conference last week. Mandy and I were both there. And this was the big topic amongst the child activists across the country. This family separation, you know, we think it's horrible, but, you know, across the country, people are saying, you know, this is a bad thing.
It's a bad situation. And yeah. We're in a unique situation where, again, we are having possible new facilities opening in our backyard right here in Houston. We're facing that. What were the people from around the country saying when they're not even facing that aspect? They can just recognize the egregious nature of separating children.
No, I mean, and people put a historical perspective on this. And, you know, what sort of culture separates moms and dads from their kids and then continues to sort of drag its feet on putting these families back together? And moreover, we're getting more and more information about the damage that this does to these kids.
That's right. And not just in the short term, right?
Yeah.
This is going to have an impact on a whole generation of kids that... if we're not going to fix it now, we need to be prepared to deal with in the future.
It's bad. It's a very bad thing.
Wow. Sorry, we took that turn really quickly. Mm-hmm. But
well, you know, I can't not talk about this enough. I think this is a horrible thing.
It is, and it's important we continue to talk about it. So we've got a great show.
Yes, we do. Today, Katie McConnell is in the house
with CEO, President of Children at Risk, Dr. Bob Sanborn.
Mm-hmm. Here I am.
Here you are, ready to solve all the problems of the world.
Welcome to Growing Up in America here on Pacifica Radio. This, as always, is a discussion on our children, public policy, politics, and our future, and how do we as a nation do when it comes to taking care of all of our kids. And you ready for a little date ahead on this? So when you think of Edith, you think of poetry in motion?
That is literally what I think about every single time
I think about Edith. She is just so smooth.
So
Edith Rahimian. Edith, your parents sort of, is your middle name smooth? I'm just wondering.
No, I don't have a middle name.
Well, you've just earned yourself one.
Yes, there we go.
You do now.
ESR, Edith Smooth Rahimian. And so Edith is the director of our Center for Parenting and Family Well-Being. And
she's here to talk to us this afternoon about the number $27.6 billion. Did you have an estimate about what that might be, Dr.
26.
Sanborn?
$27.6 billion.
Billion with a B.
So is this have something to do with parenting, Edith?
Somewhat, yes.
Tell
something
us about
that it. Parents are doing.
Oh, doing. So they're spending. Parents, child care? Is it related to child care?
No, it is not child care, but you're on the right track by saying spending.
Okay, what is it?
It is the estimated amount that parents are spending on back-to-school supplies.
Holy cow.
Wow.
$27 billion.
Yes.
And is that across the nation, Edith?
Across the nation, according to a Deloitte 2018 back-to-school report that just came out.
What does this mean? I mean, when parents are spending this much, what does it mean for poor families, Edith?
I think it becomes an equity issue, right? There are kids then who feel very left out when they're coming back to school. There's anxiety associated with it. As a former teacher, I know that I had my back-to-school supply list for my classroom. And I think teachers need to be very aware that there are certain kids that just can't meet some of these requirements and making the environment as comfortable for those children as well. And so putting systems in place so that those families or those kids can conference with you or work with the school counselor or school social worker, to ensure that they have their supplies and that they're not alienated. They're not the ones that look singled out for not having the supplies with them within the first week.
Well, and I remember going back to school time. It was always so exciting. And true confession, City of Houston, I still get excited about school supplies. It's something I love. I know Edith can relate to this, right? Buying the new pens and all of those things, but always want, you know, save my money over the summer to buy a new trapper keeper to start back to school.
What?
Trapper keeper.
What's a trapper keeper?
You didn't have a trapper keeper.
I remember those.
What are trapper
keepers?
It was the best.
It was essentially just a hard plastic outside for some folders to stick into, a big three-ring binder.
This is something kids bought?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow.
In the 80s. And I'm sure, actually, your little Jenny probably had the Lisa Frank's version of that. That's kind of what it evolved into.
Yeah, lots of Lisa Frank things. Yes, my little Jenny did.
But, you know, I look at that, and, you know, that was something that it was so meaningful and so important to have those going into school. To imagine not to have those or to feel isolated or left out, as Edith was alluding to, is really, it's heartbreaking to think about the impact that something that simple could have, knowing that we're still spending $27.6 billion.
Mm-hmm. Edith and Katie, both of you as teachers, and Katie, you as a former principal, one of the things for me as a student of lesser means, right, growing up, the anxiety for me was around uniforms.
Oh, right.
And when there were no uniforms, you know, what are the clothes that I was, because, you know, my mom was searching to buy the cheapest sneakers possible.
Sure.
And if there were no uniforms, it was tough. But even when there were uniforms, you know, I was getting the cheapest version. And this seems to be a thing that kids have still have a lot of anxiety
absolutely,
about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the shoes are, you know, very oftentimes talked about conversation. But I was fortunate that my mom was actually a seamstress. So she was able to make a lot of clothes. You know, again, just to date myself a little bit, jams were cool. Well, we couldn't afford name brand jams, but my mom.
What are jams? What are
they
jams?
Were like long Hawaiian shorts with a wide elastic waistband.
You could wear those to school?
Yeah, we didn't have school uniforms when I was in elementary.
Wow.
So she could buy a dollar worth of fabric from Cloth World, another flashback,
and make them
so I could still kind of fit in.
Did you see this with kids, Edith, in your school and when you were a teacher?
Yeah, so when I was in school, our school didn't have uniforms, but the same thing. We would go to these the clothing and the fabric district in downtown LA and get our clothing for a dollar, anywhere between $1 to $4, and that's what we would wear. I had a fun time being bullied because of my outfits.
Went to Beverly Hills High School too, so that was like a deal, what, right? And you always hate when I bring that up, don't you?
Yes. but it definitely was impacted kind of my experience during school. And then as a teacher for our students, we had uniforms for the students that were a requirement. And many of our schools in our district provided the first uniform shirt for free to families.
Hmm.
And then if families could not afford to purchase the uniforms, they worked with our school social worker or counselor, and were able to receive the uniforms as well. Since we sold the uniform shirts too, we sold them at cost to the kids.
Wow.
So it wasn't going to cost them any more than it would if they went to Target or Walmart.
We've digressed around the uniforms, but when we talk about some of these school supplies, what per family, what's the average on this that families are spending around school supplies?
Right. Per family, it's about $510 per average. And another study showed that 60% of U.S. parents actually struggle to pay for their school supplies.
That's really incredible. And I think thinking about the news report I saw this morning, I'm looking at it with a completely different frame because they were talking about buying things at Target versus buying things at a dollar store.
Mm.
And you assume the dollar store, you're going to get a better deal. But in school, this time of year, it's better to shop around a little bit to compare because some of even the big box stores have relatively cheap supplies at this point in the year.
How does this, you know, the fact that so many teachers, Edith, have to buy supplies and that are asking kids to do the, you know, paper towels and the Kleenex and all this sort of stuff, how does that affect families?
I think one is sometimes families don't understand why there's something like paper towels or tissues on the school supply list. And I remember I definitely had families who would write me notes or would call me and would say, I am not buying this. I'll buy everything else, but I refuse to buy that. And I had to explain as to why it was on the list and how it actually ensured time on task. Right, kids leave your classroom to then go to the restroom to use the tissue or get paper towels, but we want them in our classrooms as much as possible. And so if we just have the tissues and the towels in the classroom, then the kid gets to stay in the classroom during instructional time as well.
Wow.
It's amazing things we don't think about, a tissue, right, that could have that much of an impact, but it does. Edith, it's back to school time. I know we'll have the opportunity over the course of the next month or so to engage in a lot of education conversations, so I look forward to many more hearty discussions with you around these topics.
Yeah, I think, and one of the things that Shannon and Laura, who are producing the show, we need to get more, maybe this next month, more back to school stuff on there.
Back to school-y. Let's talk a little bit. Yeah.
Some good stuff here. Edith Rahimian is the director of the Center for Parenting and Family Wellbeing at Children at Risk. She works all over the state for the betterment of parenting. And thank you so much, Edith, for what you do. And thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you. Have a great show.
All righty. Take
Thanks.
Care. Bye-bye. You're listening to Growing Up in America on KPFT Pacifica Radio. And just this whole idea back to school, to me, it is striking, right? How much we spend on all these back to school things,
and not just the families, but also our schools and our teachers and our counselors and our school nurses, everybody that contributes to that school community, right? It really, at a personal cost, a lot of times we just assume those costs because we know our kids need it.
Katie, you were a principal in Alief ISD, and you were at a very poor school.
That is.
And when you would compare yourself to, you know, you had buddies who were at more affluent, you know, in Katie ISD and some of the more affluent districts. When you saw those kids coming in with their school supplies, how did it compare? I mean, and how did it make you feel as a principal and for your teachers?
You know, I think the most drastic thing that we would see is they might, oftentimes my kids would come in without even essentials. And I mean, very essentials like socks and underwear.
Right.
And they would come in, they may have a new pair of shoes for the first day of school, but they don't have any socks to wear under those shoes, or they don't have, like one of our good friends, Rabbi Amy Weiss has the undies for everyone. You know, kids don't have underwear or underwear that fits or underwear that's new. That impacts their ability to learn. Mm-hmm. So when I would look at that, I would think on that very basic level, the kids, my kids, all 900 of them that were mine, were already starting behind some of their same age peers that had the privilege, if you will, of having things like socks and underwear.
Wow.
And it motivated me to do what I did then and what I do now.
But you have a lot of teachers, and you as a principal, you guys would spend a lot of your own money,
to
help these kids out, because you're seeing it firsthand.
That's right. And I knew, too, that the immediate impact that me spending that money could have. I could have that kid that perhaps had gotten an office referral because they were so uncomfortable or, you know, just kind of discombobulated. If I could provide that resource for them, they could get back to the classroom and get back on task.
Very good. All right, you ready to move on to Dr. Hollier?
Lisa Absolutely.
Hollier. Yeah, so we have a little theme music for Lisa, do we?
You always love theme music.
On the line with us is Dr. Lisa Hollier. She is the chair of the Texas Maternal Mortality and Morbidity Task Force, the chief medical officer for Texas Children's Health Plan. Dr. Hollier, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Right. Hollier, right? Did I get that right?
Hollier.
Wow.
Yes.
Is that like French, Lisa?
It is. My husband is a Cajun from South Louisiana.
Say no more. Olier.
Yes.
That was good. You even got the accent that time, too. That was great.
And who doesn't like a good Cajun, right? My own wife is from Louisiana, so I'm with you, Lisa.
Wonderful.
So, Dr. Olier, I wanted to talk about maternal mortality statewide. How does Texas look in comparison to other states?
You know, it's interesting. In 2016, we were quoted as being the worst in the country with a maternal mortality rate that looked like it was about 38 per 100,000 live births. Recently, we have taken an in-depth look into those numbers, and that maternal mortality rate that we calculated was significantly less. The trick is, it's really hard to compare the new rate that the task force calculated, because other states aren't reporting that detailed level that we reported. So my best guess, that's what this will be, a professional guess, is that we're probably somewhere in the middle of the pack. we definitely have opportunities to improve.
And when you look at maternal mortality, I would guess, but you're the expert on that, poverty and families in poverty should have a significant impact on that overall number, does it?
Yes, the social determinants of health are major contributors to maternal mortality and morbidity. Access to care is also another critical contributor. We know that women who, for example, enroll late into prenatal care have a significantly increased risk of maternal mortality.
I know, you know, we were kind of kicking this idea around this morning and talking about it a little bit. This time last year, our legislature went into special session with this task force that was really trying to help this number. This is when we were in the middle of the pack, right? That we were leading a pack that we didn't want to lead.
Yeah, that we didn't want to lead.
What progress has been made? What are we seeing? What do moms and babies, what are we doing for them at this point in time?
You know, we have got one really exciting program that was kicked off by the Department of State Health Services in the beginning of June, and it's called Texas AIM. And what this program does is it addresses a very, very common and very preventable cause of maternal mortality in the initial hospitalization, and that's severe bleeding or hemorrhage. And this program called AIM is especially exciting because we have evidence from other states that there are significant improvements in the rate of complications after these bundles have been implemented in hospitals. So this is a really exciting new thing that Texas is doing. And I want you to know when we kicked off on June 4th, there were 160 hospitals who were planning on participating. We're now up to 180 Texas hospitals who will be participating in the program. So that's really exciting news for Texas moms.
That is exciting. And what exactly does this Texas AIM program entail?
The program involves the implementation of best practices that help in four particular areas. One of them is readiness. The second is recognition. The third is response. And then the fourth is reporting. So just as some examples of these best practices for readiness, this would include things like pulling all of the supplies that you might need in an emergency situation of heavy bleeding so that everything is ready for you anytime, and it takes just a second to grab, for example, a cart with all those supplies, bring them in so that everything is ready. Recognition. There are best practices that help nurses, OB-GYN physicians, anesthesiologists, identify blood loss or bleeding before it becomes extremely serious so that a woman can get the treatment that she needs much more rapidly. And that's the R, the response, right? So it's best practice protocols for treatment for severe bleeding so that it does not progress. And then finally, there's that reporting piece. So this is where you track how you perform as a labor and delivery unit, how you perform as a hospital, and by having those numbers available, you can continuously improve the work that you're doing to make that delivery safer.
That's great. It's always exciting to hear about implementing some accountability that's going to help save lives of babies and mothers in this situation. That is glad to see Texas making some progress in that regard.
Dr. Ollier, when we look at the numbers of babies born across the state, right, 1 in 10 children born in America born in the state of Texas, but when we look at that majority, right, it's younger families, and younger families in our state tend to be Latino. Are there specific risk factors amongst Latino moms that we see when we look at maternal mortality?
Yes. When we're looking at rates of particular complications that are associated with maternal mortality, one of those is the mom having diabetes. Diabetes is an important contributor to maternal mortality. And when we look at changes in the rates of diabetes in Texas, for example, over the last 10 years, that rate has been significantly increasing for all women. But Latina women have more diabetes than either African American or Caucasian women. So the presence of diabetes is an important risk factor in the Latina population.
And then a final question related to that, infant mortality, how is that related to maternal mortality?
There are a number of situations where we can see both happening, right?
Yeah.
So complications like severe early high blood pressure for mm-hmm. women can threaten their lives, but can also threaten their baby's lives with a variety of complications like the placenta separating too soon or simply going into preterm labor. So there are complications that can cause mortality for both of them. And, you know, diseases like we've been talking about, problems
yeah.
like diabetes and high blood pressure, certainly both of those are associated with complications for both mothers and newborns.
Dr. Lisa Ollier, she is the chair of the Texas Maternal Mortality and Morbidity Task Force and the chief medical officer at Texas Children's Health Plan. Lisa, thank you so much for being on the program. Thank you for what you do over there at Texas Children's. You guys do some great work.
You betcha. We want to keep those moms and babies healthy.
Absolutely.
That's right. That's what we want to.
Lisa, we need to have you back on again when we have a little bit more time. Are you up for that?
Absolutely. Anytime. Delighted to talk with you again.
Very
good.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Ollier. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Growing Up in America on Pacifica Radio, 90.1 KPFT. And here with me is Katie McConnell.
Right here, present.
Very good.
Ready. Still, my mind is stuck on that conversation we were just having. I'm glad we're moving to our next guest.
You ready to talk a little bit about lactation and breastfeeding?
I'm ready to talk a little bit about lactation and breastfeeding.
Do we have a theme
song?
So
much to learn
that?
Here.
Let's hear.
Life givers, giving mothers milk. Life givers, giving the milk.
Shannon could pick a song, right? She could pick a good song,
givers,
I'm saying.
That's exactly what I was just thinking.
Amy Will is on the line with us. Amy leads the Infant Nutrition and Nurture Engagement Team for Harris County Health. Amy, how you doing?
Hi, how are you guys? I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You know, Katie and I were talking about how they're either it's a taboo or people don't talk about it enough, but this whole idea of breastfeeding and sort of the essential infant care that breastfeeding is. I mean, you obviously, though, Amy, talk about it all the time, but do you feel sometimes that people think, oh, I don't really want to talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. And that's something that we definitely need to change as a community,
mm-hmm.
Something that's really important to our maternal and infant mortality and morbidity rates, especially in Texas, where we do have lots of moms and babies born every day, like Dr. Ollier was talking
yeah.
about. I talk about breasts, nipples, and babies all the time, every day. But every one of us in our community somehow knows a breastfeeding baby, a child who has been breastfed,
yeah.
or you know, has a friend or a neighbor or a family member that has been through a breastfeeding experience. So it's important for us to know at least the basics and at least feel comfortable talking about feeding babies at the breast, which is our biological norm.
And Amy, about what percentage of babies, either born in Houston or born in Texas, do moms breastfeed, and how does that compare to national norms?
So when we talk about the state of Texas, our initiation rates or breastfeeding in the hospital are actually
yep.
particularly high.
Uh-huh.
We have over an 85% initiation
oh,
rate.
Wow.
That's good. That's
so,
higher than I would have thought of.
Yeah, a lot of our moms want to breastfeed.
Mm-hmm.
Our parents want to provide human milk for their babies. It is about continuation and sustaining that breastfeeding relationship where Texas starts to drop off considerably. We need that community support and understanding of breastfeeding human milk as the norm in order to change that. So the statistic right now stands around only 20% or fewer of our infants being breastfed until they're 12 months old.
Oh, wow.
And
that's a dramatic
drop-off
there.
Drop. Yeah. For sure. And we know from current research that most of that does not have to do with the fact that a mom can or cannot produce enough milk for her baby.
Right.
It absolutely has to do with the environment and the social aspects of her life to be able to successfully continue breastfeeding her baby.
And what's the best practice, Amy? Is the best practice to breastfeed until 12 months, or what should happen?
What should happen? What should happen is that mom and baby should be supported to breastfeed, or for mom to provide human milk for her baby until that baby outgrows the need for breast milk or human milk.
And what is the age usually about that?
Yeah,
that?
So usually it would be 12 months.
Okay.
Or further if that baby is still breastfeeding or taking human milk in a cup or in a bottle, usually a cup at that point, depending on the age and developmental stages of the child. But worldwide, if we think about all of our compatriots internationally, children breastfeed in other countries until they're done breastfeeding, and that would be the ideal. But here in the U.S., our environment and our social environment really doesn't cater to that.
So
usually around 12 months is when the weaning process starts.
Amy, let me ask you a question, and this may be something is very common knowledge and I just don't know, so I apologize.
No problem.
But can you
ask away?
I would suspect there's probably other people out there too that don't know, why is the breast milk so important?
Yeah,
why
that's
is
a good
that
question.
Why you I, and I've heard I've been listening very carefully to your language, and you've talked about the human norm and the natural norm.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that so important?
So the reason why human milk is so important to human babies is that mammal milk, and we're part of we're part of the mammalian group. Mammal milk is species specific.
We're mammals.
We're mammals. Yeah. Thank you for that. So mammal milk is species specific, which means cows drink cow's milk, goats drink goat's milk, horses drink horse milk, and humans drink human milk, or at least that's what the body is made to digest.
Yeah.
And human milk, no matter what your diet is, no matter where you live, is ultimately designed for your baby. And it actually not only feeds your baby, but it actively protects and helps to grow your baby's brain. So formula milk can't do that. It's made from cow's milk, protein, and carbohydrates, and it doesn't have those special carbohydrates and those special proteins that actively protect the digestive system in the body and that actually increase brain growth in the early days, weeks, and months.
That's why it's
important that babies get human milk.
Now, the other sort of big seller, I think, for breastfeeding, though, right, is that moms will lose weight when they breastfeed. They'll lose all that baby weight.
We like to tell moms that they may lose weight when they're breastfeeding. It's not the truth for every mom. It really does have to be.
You're just killing me here. You're killing me now,
mom's
Amy.
Mom's baby. I don't want to lie to anybody, right?
No, we appreciate that, but
that insight is so about the different types of milk. Like, I'm seeing it. It makes so much sense why,
right.
Again, a human would drink human milk and a goat would drink goat milk.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And goats and cows and horses and, even apes to a certain degree, their babies are so independent so soon in life. Whereas human infants take a really long time to develop the basic things that they need in order to move around, in order to get their food. And so, cows are drinking cow milk to build their muscle and build their bones to be able to go graze in the field.
And the
babies are growing their brains so that their brains can develop and so that they can develop all of the characteristics that they need as humans, and that's what human milk provides.
In the last 30 seconds that we have, Amy, one of the things that we see is that there are parts of our population that culturally it just doesn't seem acceptable, right? Like, we don't do breastfeeding, and it's not something that we do. I mean, how do you overcome some of that? Because there are parts of our population that just don't want to do breastfeeding, right?
Oh, it's absolutely true. And there is a huge stigma when it comes to the form of the female breast.
Mm-hmm.
Really what it is primarily is a delivery mechanism for our milk. But especially in our American culture, we have, embraced it as a sexual symbol, something that's pretty to look at and fun to use for a different purpose other than feeding. So the most important thing there is just having those discussions. They're difficult discussions to have, but talking about why it's uncomfortable, you know, for a certain group to talk about breastfeeding, it's important to have that discussion.
Yeah.
Because once you think about it from the perspective of the baby, that stigma just lifts up and you're like, oh my gosh, of course I want to give
of course, you know,
the babies in my community what they want.
What they need, right? What our bodies are intended to do.
We're not talking about this enough though, Katie, right?
No, we're not.
No, we've got to talk about it all the time. And that's why we're establishing a new breastfeeding coalition for the Houston area, our Intent Coalition, as you noted. And we really want to talk with everybody that will listen about infant nutrition and nurture and to have those conversations so that people feel, you know, more comfortable providing for babies.
And Amy, children at risk definitely needs to be part of this, because I think there's more that we could do at the state also to increase awareness and really to get more people talking about the importance of breastfeeding. And a lot of people think, well, La Leche League and there's other groups that have been doing this, but frankly, if the numbers go from 85 to 20%, to me, that's too dramatic of a loss. And that means our children are suffering for it. And by and large, we're talking about populations that need this.
And that's so, right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you hit the nail on the head. It's about that continuation. It's about supporting moms and babies, not just at birth, which we do a wonderful job of doing, but throughout that infancy. And La Leche League and Breastfeeding USA, the WIC program, you know, the hospitals that have celebrations for World Breastfeeding Week and prepare moms when they're leaving the hospital to be successful. All of that is part of it. But we have to continue that conversation, and we have to know as individuals in our community how we can support moms and the things that we might be doing on a day-to-day basis that are actually sabotaging their success.
Amy Willis with Harris County Health. Amy, thank you for what you do, and thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All righty. Take care. You're listening to Growing Up in America here on KPFT Pacifica Radio. Are you ready for a little thumbs up, thumbs down?
I've got my 10-point.
All year-round school year. So let's hit thumbs up, thumbs down. We're doing thumbs up, thumbs down today. 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. Should we have a longer school year? Should we have an all-year-round school year, Katie McConnell? And on the line with us,
we have the Chief of Field Services from Generation Schools, Dr. Lisa Leith. Did I get that last name right?
You did.
Very good.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I am so excited because I suspect that you're on my side here. we're here to talk about year-round school, thumbs up, thumbs down. This is a key part of your model in Generation Schools, is that correct?
Well, Generation Schools does help schools rethink the use of time, actually time and talent and resources, because we want to maximize learning opportunities. But typically we find out a lot about the school and the model that they are already implementing and the results that they've had and what they'd like to see change. And quite often, more and better learning time is a great solution. But it's not, an absolute.
Not a
and
guarantee.
So, I might be, sort of close to your side.
I can accept that. I don't know that Dr. Sanborn can.
No, I think
he's going to push you to one side of the fence or the other.
Well, we look at factors though, right? Especially with high poverty populations, that's academic time on task is probably one of the key factors though, wouldn't you say, Dr. Leith?
Absolutely, especially when you consider the impact of summer regression.
Yeah.
You know, students begin to lose what they've learned over the school year the longer they're out of school, and this has been shown to be especially true in our higher-risk populations and students who are English language learners. And so having that consistent exposure to the academic content does seem to have a positive impact on retained learning.
So I'm going to take that as an absolute for year-round school, if the situation
or longer school year, right?
Longer school year.
We're really talking about more academic time on task. Now, when we've had representatives of Generation School, like the Generation School in Denver, there have been like these 200-day school years, and is that something that you see is relatively common with the Generation Schools, Lisa?
we have many schools who do choose that longer school model. Lately, our work in Colorado is supporting schools as they are, and so we come alongside of teachers and superintendents and principals to increase the quality of their instructional time and also their culture and climate. But one of the things that we've gotten involved in quite a bit are 21st century learning centers,
yep.
and those exist over the summer. And so I see that as kind of an extension
that
of
is,
the school
yeah.
year, but specifically focused on remediation and enrichment. And, you know, another thing that happens because we work quite a bit with rural school districts and school districts where poverty is higher than it is in our school districts that are close to Denver, we find that sometimes summer can be a time with minimal supervision or even sporadic meals. So one of the things that happens when kids come to school is if they are hungry, there is someone there to
yep.
fix them a hot breakfast or lunch. And the other thing that happens sometimes is in the summer there is less adult interaction. You know, the ideal would be that the family all takes time together and travels and has vacations that expose kids to new places and new ideas. But sometimes it just means a time
well,
of
well, now you're talking a little bit more
isolation.
Affluence. But now you're talking a little bit more affluence, right? When the parents get together and we go on a summer vacation together, that's a great thing, but that's an affluent thing, right? I mean, that's not always going to happen with a lot of our kids.
No, it is not the norm in most of the school districts where we work.
Yeah.
And so we find that kids have little guided in activity. Sometimes they're being supervised by a child that's not much older than they
right.
are. And so, you know, their schedules are not as predictable. Their meals are not as don't come as expected. And sometimes things that are flags to teachers to say, hey, this child is really on my radar and they need some extra support, the signs of neglect or abuse or, you know, maybe extreme hunger or fear, those children are seen by an adult every day if they're coming to a school building and not necessarily if they're off in the summer and they don't have a parent that's able to be available for them.
Or if, just going to say, you know, I'm just listening, kind of picking up on the keywords that you're saying here. And one word that you've said several times is quality as well.
Yeah.
That matters. We're not going to extend the school year or extend the school day just for the sake of doing it, right?
Right.
We want to be sure we're providing an environment where kids are having meaningful time on task, where there is, to the last example you were using, those adults there that are in tune and can help perhaps connect to other community resources that they might be in need of, or, you know, detect if there's something really off in their person so we can really use that time to help them, not just...
And that's often the biggest argument, right, against longer school day, longer school year, is that if it's not high quality to begin with, why extend that time if it's not high quality? But indeed, when you do have high quality, that extension of time makes all the sense in the world.
A huge difference.
Yeah. So when we look at thumbs up...
That's what the research says.
Exactly. So when we look at this overall, Lisa, in terms of a thumbs up, thumbs down... If we're talking about low-income populations where the parents are working anyway, the idea of a longer school year seems to make, and when you try to minimize summer loss and when you try to maximize the feeding of these kids and the time that these kids spend in school, to me it's a big thumbs up. Would you agree with that, Lisa? I mean, you're giving some qualifications on it there, right?
Hey.
Well, I would absolutely say it's an option that should be considered. Thumbs up to doing some research and finding out whether you can resource some enrichment and remedial programs and other advantages that students aren't getting in the traditional year. Thumbs up to investigating it as one of the solutions that's going to support you in serving
yeah.
all your children.
And you know what I say? I say it's been investigated, right? I think there's enough research for us to say, and we know in Texas, right, high-performing, high-poverty schools, in every instance, it's more time on task. Thumbs up from me, a modified thumbs up from Lisa. Where do you stand, Katie?
I'm going to go with thumbs up, full-on thumbs up. I can't argue on this one. This is something I feel really strongly about. Sorry.
Yeah. Dr. Lisa Leith is the Chief of Field Services at Generation Schools. I love the people at Generation Schools. Thank you, Lisa, very much for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye. You're listening to Growing Up in America, KPFT, Pacifica Radio. You ready to move on to our guest of the hour?
I can't wait to hear what Anne has to say. It's been, 2 weeks since we've talked to her, I think. So.
No, I would not give you false hope.
Oh, she's got a good little theme song.
It is a great theme song. Very fitting
Mother
for
and Child
person.
Reunion. Yeah. Oh, Ann Chandler is our good buddy from the Tahereh Justice Center here in Houston. Ann, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you, Bob and Mandy? Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so it's Bob and Katie today. Katie's with us today.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Okay. Hi.
And what is the update on, I mean, we were talking at the top of the hour, right? This whole idea, you know, we thought a couple weeks ago, and I think the last time I talked to you was maybe 6 weeks ago, when we thought the president said we're not going to separate families. We thought that was the end of it. 6 weeks later, we still have hundreds of families still separated.
You're right. I mean, we're deeply disappointed right now that the Department of Homeland Security, despite President Trump putting his pen to paper and signing an executive order ending family separation and calling upon his administration to reunite the parents with the children, we're seeing that it really, for over 500 children, it hasn't happened. And
yeah.
We have over 500 individuals, many who are in Houston's, detention shelters for children, still without their parents.
Yeah.
Well, and I, you know, when we think, again, in terms of back to school time, the impact we're about to feel here is so substantial. Like, I just think about these kids that we know need to be getting quality care or getting enrolled in our schools. What is the kind of future outlook look like at this point in time? And do we anticipate that we're going to see any progress anytime soon?
Did we lose her? Yeah.
All right, we're working on technical difficulty.
Tech line, or were we? There, are you there, Ann?
I am here.
Oh, very good. So,
yeah.
So, what? I mean, is this going to finish up soon, Ann?
We hope so. You know, part of the problem here is that the Department of Homeland Security, when they started taking children from their parents without any finding of neglect or abuse, did so without really a plan in place and without interagency coordination. So what we saw was the immigration courts and the Department of Homeland Security deporting over 400 of the parents. And many of these parents were told, hey, your child has already been sent home, or
yeah.
We're going to have your child at the airport. And the parents were sent home without their children. And it's been the position of the Department of Homeland Security in this class action suit that's taking place with a federal judge out in San Diego, that it's not the Department of Homeland Security's responsibility to find the parents, and instead it's the ACLU should take on that chore. And so we don't know when these children are actually going to be able to find their mother or their father.
And there are a couple of other new rules that Jeff Sessions has sort of talked about, and under new restrictions that he put into place. What are those? And it seems like it just gets worse, right?
I think for refugee and asylee and immigrant children right now, this is really a dark moment. It does get worse. And part of this is that separating parents was just one piece of the pie of an overall policy of what Jeff Sessions is calling zero tolerance. And zero tolerance to asylum seekers, zero tolerance to individuals who are seeking safety at our borders. So what that means for a lot of unaccompanied children who are arriving, who say, I can't go back to my home country because the gangs are recruiting me or there's family violence.
Yeah.
Many of those children have to rely on our asylum law. And Jeff Sessions is kind of unilaterally trying to change that definition of what does it mean to be categorized as an asylee, taking away a lot of the original protections that pertain to individuals fleeing child abuse or when there's family violence in that household. And so it's tough. If you're a kid, you know, seeking shelter on our shore right now, it's a dark moment.
Do you think that when the administration decided that they were going to do this family separation, and they did it as a deterrent, right? They stated it that it was a deterrent to bring families in. Did they really understand the damage that was happening to these kids, to these families? And they obviously didn't expect the blowback that came from groups all over our country saying, hey, do you guys know what you're doing? Do you think they've seen the light, or they just don't want to hear bad publicity?
I'm going to hope that they've seen the light. I want to imagine a world where really they just did not sit and pause long enough to evaluate and digest the type of trauma that a child experiences in this situation, mm-hmm. where they're already usually coming from a situation of quite volatility, where there's been harm, rape, you know, assassinations of family members. And then the migrant trail itself, many of these families, many of these kids suffer and see things that no child should see. Yeah. While they're traveling from Central America to the border, and then when they arrive unexpectedly to be yanked from their parents, and when that happened, it wasn't like they put the parents and the kids in a room and explained in Spanish, this is what's going to happen and this is what's going to expect. Instead, in more cases than not, the child had absolutely no opportunity to even say goodbye to their kid, because they would use acts of deception in separating the child.
And we're dealing with it, you know, to that point, we're dealing with children facing a lot of trauma, right? We know this is going to have a long-term impact. You had the opportunity this past weekend, I know, to speak with the American Bar Association at their annual meeting in regards to this topic. What is, from that perspective, what is the kind of the national perspective? What are people saying? Can we anticipate that there's going to be any real progress anytime soon?
Oh, great question. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, we are really proud that the American Bar Association, as well as a lot of associations, came out in really a strong voice of horror and condemnation against this policy. And so we hope that no federal administration will ever, without any due process, without any finding of child endangerment, strip parents from their children again. And as to, you know, what do we still do with the pieces that we're working with? I think we're looking for leadership, or still for the Department of Homeland Security or Jeff Sessions to step up and say, this is our plan in place. We know in Houston, you know, we have roughly 7 shelters that are housing these kids. And we've heard stories of these kids being put on vans out of Houston down to the border, down to the Brownsville-Harlingen area, to be waiting in a detention center parking lot called Port Isabel Detention Center. Mm. And that's where all the parents who were put in detention centers as far as Seattle and New York, they brought all the parents in, and then some of the children were told, I'm sorry, we found that your parent is unfit, or, oh, we realize your parent has been deported, and then they brought those kids back to Houston. And, you know, I just can't imagine how somber that van ride was back to Houston.
Yeah,
to realize that those kids are not being, that they're not able to actually be with their parents.
The trauma and the long-term impact there, the trust that's been broken that will take a lifetime to rebuild.
Yeah, and you know, we hear, you know, where, you know, in these detention centers, you know, they're constructed and all the policies are meant for unaccompanied children. So you have, which by definition are individuals who arrive on their own, not by individuals who are rendered unaccompanied because of a policy. So the average child traditionally is 15, 16, 17 years of age. And so there are policies put in place that really make sense for that population, such as no hugging, right? No
ridiculous.
Comfort. And yet when you have a 4 and 6-year-old, you know, who
that
are
that's
just
all they need. Trauma.
Yeah. It's and then all the individuals that are dealing with an additional layer of trauma that was created, you know, by our administration, our policies, it is quite horrific. And the kids are the ones who are paying the price.
That's right.
And before we get to our final four questions with you, what should the general public be doing? I mean, everyone is outraged, but it does seem to me that not enough people people are doing this, but not enough people are calling their representatives, U.S. representatives and U.S. senators. I mean, I talked to Senator Cornyn's office the other day, and I feel like we should be more people should be calling Senator Cornyn's office and Senator Cruz's office and Representative Culberson and Jackson Lee and Poe. And they need to be calling all of our representatives. I mean, do you fall under that same? I mean, do we need that? And what else can we be doing?
No, I couldn't agree more with you. It is not too late to still be talking and calling your representatives. Say, you know, whatever our policies are for immigration, that people might have very different opinions of how open our doors should be when it comes to refugee or asylum issues. But to think that we're going to put policies in place that intentionally, you know, harm and traumatize children is horrific. And make those calls and say the job isn't done yet until every single child has been reunited with their parents and every single child has a reasonable opportunity to avail themselves to the protections under U.S. law.
I appreciate your...
make those calls. They're critically important right now, and thank you for calling.
Yeah, we need to do that. And so let's do a quick final 4:54 with Ann Chandler from Tahereh. You ready for question number one?
I am, because we can't. We know this is an important issue we need to be talking about, but we want to make sure that we go out learning just a little bit more about one of our local celebrities here, Ann Chandler.
Yes, that's what she is. Ann Chandler's
a
local celebrity.
I mean, she's basically a local celebrity who's helping to lead this fight and doing a great job, might I add. First, Ann, what was your favorite toy to play with as a kid?
Oh, that's a great question. My favorite toy as a kid. Well, I had a yellow mongoose dirt bike when I was 6 years old that I insisted on bringing into my classroom as a kindergarten.
Oh, wow.
Does that count?
That absolutely counts. That tells the full story right there. Yeah. Question two. When you were growing up, what did you dream about being? What was your dream career?
Oh, I wanted to be a ski patrol.
Ski patrol.
I was fascinated with the fact that people got paid and could make a living on ski.
Did you ski as a kid, Ann?
Oh, I did learn how to ski. I did.
Wow.
That's amazing. Yeah. That wasn't something kids in Texas thought a lot about, being ski patrol. Can't say anyone of my friends ever had that dream.
Question number three. What was your favorite book as a kid, Ann?
Well, I love the Judy Blume series.
Oh, Judy Blume, yeah.
Of course, always
like
the crowd favorite.
And then your favorite, number four, your favorite TV show as a kid.
The Brady Bunch.
I knew you were going to start singing.
The Brady Bunch. That's the way we became the Brady Bunch.
And on that note, Dr. Bob Sanborn, thank you so much. Ann, thanks for calling in today.
Keep
up the good work. We'll be
in touch.
Thanks,
Ann. Yeah, we have to keep looking at this thing. So we'll be in touch with you.
All right. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for all you do. Take care. And thank you for being on Growing Up in America. And thank you, Katie, for being on Growing Up in America.
It was wonderful. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. We had some great conversations. I feel like I need to go run a lap around the block.
Hug your kids, everyone. Take care of the kids in your community. I want to thank Katie. I want to thank Don being on the board. This is Shannon's last week as producer.
That's right.
Yeah, we're going to miss Shannon.
McCurdy.
Thank Laura.
Thank you.
We thank you all for being there. We'll see you next time on Growing Up in America here on Pacifica Radio.